everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Crime and Coffee Couple. My name's Allison.
And my name's Mike.
Hi, Mike.
Hey, Al. How you been, babe?
I've been okay.
Yeah, besides the horrible stitches in your ear?
Yeah, it's been quite a week.
Yeah, as a lot of you folks remember, Allison had a little skin cancer scare there last week. Nothing small about cancer. That word sucks, but... yeah, it seems like the doctor said they got it all, which is good. So now you're on the recovery. Literally like took a chunk, they took a lot of the skin off.
They did. So I had to go on Tuesday to have what's called a Mohs procedure, where they remove layer by layer of skin until you have clear margins with no more cancer remaining. And they have no idea how much they're going to have to take. It all depends on, they like do this cryo thing and freeze the tissue and then look at it. And with the ear, there's really not much skin to work with as it is.
Right.
And it's supposed to be a skin sparing procedure. But the first round, I saw how much she removed and I was utterly shocked.
Because you're a weirdo. And she was like, "You want to see it?" And you're like, "Yeah."
Mm-hmm. So it was very scary. We were at the dermatologist for like 5 hours on Tuesday. It was more emotional at first than I thought it was going to be because I was very nervous and scared and I didn't know what to expect.
Yeah, me too.
And I could see how much she took and I was like, oh man, this closure the following day is going to be really rough. So I was just spiraling ahead. But thankfully, you were with me. You weren't in the room while I was having the removals done, but
they don't
allow
it. They said no husbands in the room.
That doctor particularly. She said she just doesn't want to have to deal. She said people have fainted.
Just another.
She wants to focus on the patient, not have to worry about the person that's in the room.
Another variable.
Exactly. So, but you were in the waiting room the whole time, and that's where we like had to sit. Most of the time we were just waiting.
Yeah, not a lot of snacks to be had in the waiting room.
But you gave me so much comedic relief to help with my stress.
It was like stir craziness, you know, because you had to wait an hour between or an hour and a half between sessions of like, you know, they did you say this already where they cut the skin off, then they test it and all that. Okay. So while they were like testing it to see if they got everything, it's just like,
we're just sitting in the waiting room.
Yeah.
So it was hilarious because they're like, you know, we have coffee and snacks and things and we were getting hungry. I was too nervous to eat. But Mike's like, I'm kind of hungry. I'm going to look to see what kind of snacks they have in this basket. And it's just like chips and things.
There was like one thing. I didn't want chips. I wanted something with like a little protein or something. And there was like one thing of like peanuts. And then like that, after that, like 20 minutes, that was gone because one of the staff members took it.
And Mike was like, a nice rotisserie chicken would be good.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, it was sitting on a cabinet. I'm like, I'm sure in that cabinet, there's a spit just roasting and turning with that chicken on it.
Oh, man.
And I was just dying, which I needed to laugh at that point. Yeah. So,
and I mean, another reason they wouldn't have rotisserie chicken in that office is because they would smell like dead skin being burned. So that would probably be like, oh my God, they're really roasting the skin in the back because, you know, they got to suture everything. And all
yeah,
that.
They cauterized my ear several times. And then the next day I had to go back and the plastic surgeon had to do a skin flap and close it. My entire ear is all stitched up. It's horrifically painful and ugly. But the point is they got all the cancer.
Yeah. And something fun. I got to wash your hair today. I got to hover over you.
Oh my God, what a shit show.
Yeah, that was fun.
So I had to lay back on the bathtub like with this poof underneath me. And Mike is basically freaking straddling me.
Yeah, I had to ask her if she could smell anything. Like, I hadn't showered yet.
Because he had been coaching our son's baseball game that morning.
So it was touch and go there for a little bit.
He's like, I hope I don't stink. I'm like, oh, I didn't expect you to be straddling me during this process.
Neither did I. And then I started just kind of giving her little kisses on the head and stuff. And then, maybe occasional lip kiss. You're like, all right, get off me.
Get off me. Yeah. I was holding a cup over my ear so that the stitches didn't get wet. And he's like messing or clowning around.
Clowning.
Like,
that's me.
Stop clowning around.
Right. Yeah. But that went okay. It seems like your hair is good, right?
It's okay. Yeah.
If you're wondering, if you're watching on YouTube, check us out on YouTube and even just subscribe because we're trying to grow that channel.
Mm-hmm.
But check us out on YouTube. And Allison doesn't have her headphones totally on because the left one, you know, that's where the cut is. So you might be looking at it and be like, wow, why does she have headphones? But no, she doesn't have it on the left.
Yeah, it's not a cut. I literally have no skin on the cartilage of my ear. So it's all just nothing but stitches.
We'd post it, but we don't want to
gross anybody out. Exactly. It's a Frankenstein ear. I told the doctor, I'm like, my ear modeling days are over.
Done and done.
So with that, that's kind of been our week.
Yeah, yeah, it has. I've been, if I could take a second here, because we're all talking about Allison.
It's all about me today.
Yeah, and her cancer and whatever. Ooh, like, yeah, it's
you
so
have
important.
Cancer.
Yeah, big deal. Keep on talking. But I've been really like just listening to Nirvana's Nevermind album quite a bit. Just today, like I was just sitting there. You walked in while I was like singing it.
Shirtless.
Well,
why? I don't know. Why is he sitting shirtless in the computer room?
It's our home, you know.
Singing along to Nirvana.
Yeah, and I had the lyrics up on Amazon Music, and I was just like, oh yeah, and I saw the lyrics, and I just kept on going. I was having a good time jamming out.
I'm glad that you were.
Yeah.
And then just real quick, if you guys like what you hear, if you want to support us, we do have, 4 bonus episodes a month.
Yep.
We're over on Patreon as well as Apple subscriptions, and we would love to have you. And we appreciate you all. And thank you just for being here.
Yeah. If you subscribe, you get over 40 bonus episodes. So, you know, throw a shekel over to this Mom and Pop podcast. I'm Pa.
And I'm Ma.
Yeah.
And we got to be over 50 at this point.
Oh, and if you've listened 3 times, our general rule, and you'd enjoy our content, the general rule is it's time to put out. So, you know, we've been on some nice dates, really enjoyed our time together. Let's at least make out a little bit.
Oh,
with some
gosh.
With some tongue. And I mean, you know, as long as everybody's into that.
It has to be consensual.
Consensual, 100%.
100%.
So, you know, we are extending our tongue and we would like your tongue.
Oh my gosh. No, I am not extending my tongue to anybody.
I would like your tongue to enter my mouth by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts.
That's disturbing and weird.
Yeah,
why do you always have to take that line and cross it?
Oh, you know what's fun? A lot of my coworkers are going to be listening to this for the first time this week because I told them about it at our sales meeting.
Well,
so
now you look very unprofessional.
Okay. If you're a coworker, I don't want you to stick your tongue in my mouth because I'm married to a beautiful woman, obviously.
But what about the others?
Yeah, that's fine.
That's fine. But yeah, you're married. Sure.
Well,
anyway. All right. So this is a listener suggestion from Madre X4. So thank you so much. This is the disappearance of Michelle Ann Harris. So in 2001, Michelle Ann Harris was a 35-year-old mother of 4 who suddenly vanished after she finished her shift at a restaurant in Waverly, New York. Michelle was born Michelle Ann Taylor on September 29th, 1965. She met her husband, Cal Harris, in the early 1980s. Cal was a Vestal High School graduate who went on to Hobart College. There, he was a 4-year letterman for the lacrosse NCAA Division III champion teams. Cal went on to become a prominent businessman. He was from a wealthy, influential family. His father, Dwight Harris, managed a string of car dealerships that his 3 sons helped him run. So Michelle went on to earn an associate's degree from State University of New York, Morrisville. So when she was newly out of college, she happened to take a job as a secretary at one of the dealerships. And this is the dealership where she was at in Tioga County in upstate New York.
Oh, dealership? Didn't you say car wash?
Car dealership.
Oh, car dealership.
Yes.
Okay.
So he had a string of them.
You know, like local millionaires are usually car dealership guys. Like those guys make a ton of money. Well, a ton. Like usually the richest person in a town is somebody that owns a car dealership.
It sounds like that was Dwight Harris, and he was setting it up for his sons to take over. So it was here she got the job, and soon she caught Cal's eye. Michelle was described as magnetic. She was beautiful, full of life, very funny, just kind of easy to be around, pleasant person. So it was quick. He found her attractive. She was happy. She smiled all the time. It did not take long for her youth and positive attitude to quickly attract Cal.
How many years apart were they?
You know, I'm not 100% sure what their age gap was. Nothing significant.
Okay.
No. So by the time Cal was 27 years old, he was a successful businessman. And Michelle, the older of 2 children from a working class family, she had never met anyone quite like him. Michelle was from a small town, and Cal was able to sweep her off her feet. He whisked her away to some really cool destinations like Hawaii and Europe. And who doesn't want to go and see the world?
So I'd like to.
I would love to.
Yeah, maybe you should find yourself a car dealership guy.
I think I'm going to.
Good idea.
Maybe after this episode wraps, I'm going to head on out and find me a sugar daddy.
Okay, continue.
Should I keep you on the side? Or?
No, that's fine.
Okay, I'll drop
you. I got
you
options.
Then,
don't
like
worry,
a hot
I got
potato.
Options. Yeah.
So Cal and Michelle were married in August of 1990. They settled on a 252-acre estate outside of the village of Spencer in 1993.
252 acres. That's
mm-hmm.
a lot of land.
Huge property. And Michelle, so this is kind of near where Michelle had grown up. And the relationship began as a fairy tale. When they first got married, Michelle really could not have been happier at that time. So Cal and Michelle's first child was born in 1994. And by 1999, when Michelle was 33, she had four children under age six. And that's a lot.
Yeah.
So Cal worked hard. He provided for his family to support their expansive estate that sat on a private lake. Michelle's friends, who are Cindy and Tom Taylor, they spent a lot of weekends with the couple, and to them, it was very obvious that they loved each other. They always wanted to be together. And you know how it is. When you truly love your partner and enjoy their company, that's who you want to spend time with. And that's why us being at the dermatologist for 5 hours, like, I enjoyed the heck out of it.
Yeah, it was almost like a date, which was weird.
Yeah.
But I saw an Instagram recently, and a guy walked up to an old couple and was like, "How'd you guys meet?" And like, the guy's face lit up right away. Mm-hmm. And then so did the girls. And it was like, oh, that's so freaking sweet. And they're like, we just like each other. You know, she's like, it starts with like love and lust and passion. And then it just turns into a friendship.
A friendship, like, with respect and, yeah, you know, kindness. And I meet people at the hospital that have been married for 70 years and they're always kind to each other. That's really what I always see.
And I was like, wow, here I am, 44. And now we just have friendship too. No emotion at all. No kind of physical touch. It's nice just having a friend. So
I'm a cold fish.
Yeah, that's okay.
Go on. I love how the podcast world and our listeners think that I'm this frigid bitch.
And now my coworkers.
And now your coworkers. Yeah. Thank you, Mike.
Yep.
So at this point in time, unless they were absolutely amazingly faking it, it sounds like they were doing pretty well. They didn't seem to have any marital issues.
You can usually tell, you know, you're around a couple and they just, you can kind of get that feeling.
You can cut some tension with a knife in certain situations and you're like, that was an awkward ass dinner. So had there been any issues, Michelle truly kept them hidden. I mean, she would have needed an Oscar at that point. It seemed like they were happy. So this included friends and family, her sister-in-law, Shannon Taylor. They all saw that they were happy. So Shannon felt that from the outside looking in, and this is again Michelle's sister-in-law, Michelle's life looked perfect. She was always smiling and laughing. However, when her fourth child was born, Shannon began to see that all that was going on within the Harris house wasn't always perfect. It seems like that's when cracks really started to show. And Michelle began to open up about Cal's temper and his controlling behavior. According to Michelle, her husband expected perfection. The house needed to be in pristine order at all times, and Michelle was expected to be fit, trim, and slim. And this is a mother of four children under age, what did I say, six?
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, it's a shit show when you have children of that age. The house is not going to be perfect at all times.
Right. And yeah, every couple's different. But were they like churchgoers at all?
Not that I heard of. Okay. Not in anything that I read. So, you know, not only should the house be perfect, she should be raising these four little tiny children. She should also be fit and trim, which F that noise.
Yeah, you got to come to an agreement, you know, just like love each other for who you are.
And she had like just had a fourth baby. So if things were not to Cal's expectations, according to Michelle, he would scream and yell. Michelle felt that whatever she did, it was never going to be good enough, and she could never truly please her husband. So at that point, you start saying, F it, I'm not even going to try. What's the point? He's not going to be happy whether I kill myself or I do nothing.
That's when the resentment sets in, and it's just like, that's, you know, downward spiral.
Not good. So Cal told Michelle that she was born in Tioga Center, raised in Tioga Center, and would die in Tioga Center. Basically, you're not going anywhere.
Nice.
So he gave the impression that she was from a small town and would always be beneath his level because, of course, he was born from wealth.
What an ass. Like, who says that to their wife?
I should hope not. Nobody.
I mean, you know, maybe like there's spats of things. You say things you don't mean. But I mean, it sounds like this guy was generally just a total douche.
And the kicker is, in 1999, when Michelle was pregnant with her youngest and fourth child, she discovered that Cal was having an affair with another clerk at a dealership in Cortland County that his brother just so happened to run and own.
Guy or girl?
I assume it was a woman. Okay. They didn't say otherwise. Okay. But, you know, when you're pregnant and you're at the end of your pregnancy, you kind of just don't feel like yourself. You don't, like, I remember when I was 9 months pregnant, you handed me a Victoria's Secret catalog that came in the mail. And I was like, get that shit out of my face.
I couldn't wait to hand that to you.
It's like, you a-hole. But you know, that's a vulnerable time. And she's up to her eyeballs with little kids and child rearing. And then you find that your partner in life is cheating on you.
Yeah, that's a horrible time. It's like, you've only had like a human growing in you for 9 months. And then all of a sudden, the person that's supposed to be your best partner is just like, not not even into you at all.
So not only was he having an affair, but he justified the affair because he felt that Michelle just wasn't keeping the house up to his expectations.
Okay.
Okay. So she confronted him about the affair in the fall of 1999. He promised that the relationship would end, but she came to find out it didn't. The relationship had rekindled when they met in Daytona Beach, Florida in March of 2000. So they picked back up. So when the couple's fourth son was born, this is October of 2000, the relationship truly began to just dissolve and crumble. The couple no longer shared the same bed. Instead, Michelle began sleeping on the couch downstairs. Despite their efforts to save the marriage, Michelle filed for divorce in January of 2001 after 10 years of marriage. So according to Shannon and Michelle's brother, Greg Taylor, Cal was vehemently against the idea of divorce. It ended up leading to a bitter battle as Michelle argued with Cal over money, demanding a full accounting of his business.
I mean, again, this just seems, it's kind of reeks of super Christian. Like it kind of, because the reason that's coming up, I came across a TikTok the other day where people are saying there's like a voice that like some, you know, women use that are in a relationship where it's kind of like you're looked at as you're supposed to be just a good girl and you're supposed to like do what you're told. And then you talk like this and my family, kind of like the Duggars. Mm. Like how she has like a really high pitched voice.
Mm-hmm. That's like that, childlike.
Yes. That's the voice that they're kind of taught to use and kind of like you have your place. You better look good. The kids better be together all the time. And when I come home, I better have dinner and all that kind of stuff. And it's just like, you know, then him being super against divorce, obviously everybody is against divorce in general, but it's just, I don't know. I mean, it's curious.
So. I think it was more financially driven that he didn't want to have to give her any of his money.
That makes
sense. Is what it was more about. So, you know, she wanted to know exactly what the accounting was of his business. And Barbara Thayer, who was the family's nanny and housekeeper, believed that there was absolutely no way that Cal was going to ever allow Michelle to take his family's money. She recalls hearing many loud arguments throughout this time. Cal attempted to get Michelle's family involved. He was begging them to talk her out of the divorce, believing that she was being influenced by the people that she was associating with, and even speculated to her family that she was using drugs. And they're like, no way in hell. That's not Michelle.
I don't care, Cal. I mean, that's just how it is. You'd give up 50% of your assets unless there was a prenuptial agreement.
Right.
So that's just what it is.
Michelle confided in her sisters, telling them that during an argument in March of 2001, Cal told her that he would need a gun to kill her and the police would never find her body. During a visit to the salon in July, this is July of 2001, Michelle also allowed her hairdresser to overhear Cal's threatening her over the phone. So she's at the salon, he's ranting on the phone, and she's like, I want you to hear the way that he speaks to me. So he did hear this, the hairdresser. Her hairdresser could hear Cal threaten, drop the divorce proceedings, I will expletive kill you, Michelle. Do you hear me? I will expletive kill you.
Wow, good idea by Michelle, like letting people listen to that.
And he said, I can make you disappear. So she said that to her sisters. The hairdresser heard the same thing, threatening that, you know, something's going to happen to you. You're going to disappear. Expletive you, expletive, drop the divorce proceedings. So in June, Cal was ordered to pay Michelle $400 a week and continue to handle all of the household expenses until the divorce was finalized. The tension was very high, especially because the couple was forced by the courts to continue living under the same roof.
It's probably some legal things, which like once somebody moves out, they give up the house, basically. Yeah. So if once she moves out, she's like, you can have it, is what it's sending. So if you want part of his assets, you need to stay there.
And that's tough. So Michelle had obtained an order of protection from Cal while they continued to live together, which prohibited any mental or physical abuse. Okay.
Very broad.
Michelle was fearful of the power that both Cal and her in-laws possessed because they did come from wealth and prominence.
Yeah, we
and
all
money
know.
Can talk and buy you things.
Buy you very good lawyers that can find a somehow way in across some kind of line or something.
Mm-hmm. So Cal was ordered to relinquish all of his guns to his brothers and his father until the divorce was final and Michelle had moved out of the house. So
that's
he was not allowed
scary.
To have any weapons in the house while they were living together. But of course, there's like probably knife blocks sitting on the countertop, you know?
Sure.
So it was estimated by the court that Cal's net worth was $5.4 million. He offered her full custody of the children, which I think is kind of strange.
What a scumbag.
Like, that's very telling.
I cannot imagine offering anything. Like, I'd be like 50-50 or nothing. Like, right. You know.
And I wouldn't want to do that to the kids and take them away from you. And a settlement of $740,000 over the next 10 years. So $200,000 would be paid immediately, and then $54,000 would be given each year over the next 10 years. And this was something that Michelle initially rejected. So
yeah, that's kind of small. I mean, that's what...
Based on the fact that he's worth $5.4 million.
Yeah, was that like his lawyer's offer?
I'm sure. You know how they start low and go from there.
Yeah, but isn't it like, really, aren't we starting at 50-50 and then we're seeing where we go?
I don't know.
You know, like, and then, you know, offering $400 a week, that's not a lot either for somebody worth $5 million.
But she would be living in a paid-for house.
Okay.
She would have no other expenses.
Yeah.
It'd basically be $400 pocket cash.
Right.
So a month after their son was born, Michelle met a man named Brian Earley at a bar in November of 2000 while he was visiting the area for a hunting trip. He was from Philadelphia, where he worked as a surveyor. And it wasn't long until Michelle and Brian were discreetly meeting in the Poconos, using phone cards to communicate with when they were not together. Michelle was 11 years his senior, but they had an immediate connection. And of course, her relationship with her husband was just crumbled. At that point, she'd already, you know, been filing for divorce.
And she was vulnerable and, you know, wanted to have somebody that give her some attention and stuff. Yeah.
So Barbara Thayer, the nanny and housekeeper, remembers that on September 9th, 2001, while out horseback riding, Michelle was in an especially positive mood that day. She commented on how happy she was, how thankful she was that she was finally starting to get her life back.
That's nice.
Cal didn't yet know that Michelle had made the decision to accept his financial offer and finalize the divorce. It was only 3 days later and just hours before she was set to meet with her lawyer that Michelle suddenly vanished.
Ugh.
So Michelle had been extremely excited about starting over once the divorce was finalized. In preparation, she accepted a part-time waitressing job at a place called Lefty's. This was a restaurant in nearby Waverly. She started her job in April of 2001. In the meantime, Brian Earley left his girlfriend. He relocated to Tioga to be closer to Michelle. It was his belief that the plan was to marry soon after the divorce was finalized. However, Michelle had told her friends that she was interested in a long-term relationship with Brian, but she most certainly was not going to go from one marriage and jump into another.
Yeah, take it slow, see what happens.
So I think his perception of the relationship may have been a little different than hers. Brian gave Michelle the keys to his house so that she could let his dogs out when he needed to work late. She left some of her belongings at his house. Some nights she would stay there after work until as late as 2:30 a.m. So they were definitely getting close and cozy. At the time, Brian was not Michelle's only love interest. For 2 months, she had been in a relationship with her coworker at Lefty's. This is Michael Casper, who she had not told a soul about. Even her closest friends didn't know about it. An employee of one of the Harris family dealerships also later admitted to having makeout sessions in the back seats of cars on the lot with Michelle.
Hey, it's not illegal. She's having a good time.
Sure. There was also a man from Texas who Michelle was linked to. Little is known of him.
And I'm sure there's maybe a couple more. That's all right. Hey, you know, she's an adult. She
exactly.
can do what she wants.
So in August of 2001, tensions were finally starting to dissipate, and Cal offered Michelle $80,000 annually for alimony and child support, as well as custody of the children. Through her attorney, Michelle filed for a court-ordered appraisal of Cal's business, which would be charged to him, so he would have to pay for this appraisal. The appraisal itself was $30,000, and then the trial for the divorce litigation was set for October 22nd, 2001, but she would never make it to that point. She disappeared before then. So as summer was coming to a close and Labor Day came and went, Michelle had planned to take a trip to New York City to visit a college friend. It was going to be the second week of September that she was going to do this. She also told some friends about the trip. She said really the main goal of the trip was to sell or pawn some of her jewelry. This included her 2-carat engagement diamond ring or diamond engagement ring, excuse me, easy for me to say, so that she could earn some money for half of the down payment on the home that she and Brian planned to buy in Owego, where the kids were going to school. I think she needed $10,000 to put down towards that house.
So she was buying a house with this guy, even though she was kind of shipping some others also.
Yes, I don't think Brian was necessarily aware of the fact that there were also others on the side.
Probably not.
So at this point in time, it was said that Michelle had ran up significant debt on her credit card. She had been dealing with bounced checks, financial issues. That's why she picked up that job at Lefty's, and that's why she wanted to sell this jewelry. So now we're moving on to the fateful day we all know in history of September 11th, 2001.
Wow.
It just so happened to be the day of the fateful terrorist attacks against the United States. Barbara Thayer arrived at the Harris home at 3 p.m. that afternoon to babysit the children. When she arrived, Michelle was there. She complained about a terrible headache. She also was, you know, talking about the horrible attacks on New York City. She mentioned the fact that travel was going to be severely limited and restricted, so that her trip was likely going to be canceled. She probably wouldn't be able to get out there and pawn that jewelry. So she was also kind of stressed because she was running late for her shift at Lefty's. Her clothes were taking longer than she expected to dry in the dryer, so she was kind of hurried. So Michelle left to work at Lefty's. Her shift ended at 9 p.m. that night when the restaurant closed. Afterwards, she stood in the parking lot. Maybe she got in the car with a couple of her coworkers. This included Michael Casper, she had had the affair with.
One of her buddies.
As well as his friend, their coworker, Michael Hakes. I guess they kind of just hung out and had some drinks and just talked about what had happened that day, just as everybody did.
Yeah, it was
talking
rough.
About the terrorist attacks. So then Michelle left to go to Brian's apartment in Smithboro, where she stayed for another hour. They had some drinks and they discussed again the terrorist attacks. She told Brian that what had happened in the country that day truly did give her some perspective on the problems she had going on in her own life. It made her realize this is truly small potatoes in the grand scheme of life. According to Brian, Michelle left his apartment sometime between 11 and 11:30 p.m. that night. It sounds like it was closer to 11. And this was the last known sighting of Michelle at this point in time. So the next morning, it's September 12th, and Cal called Barbara, the nanny and housekeeper, to let her know that Michelle didn't come home from work the night before, and asked her if she could come to the house to help the kids get ready for school because he himself had to work. Michelle not coming home was not normal. She wasn't somebody that just didn't come home and wasn't there for her kids.
Yeah.
This was very weird.
Not like a drinking problem, got wasted, forgot the call. Like very, very, yeah, with her kids, knows what's going on.
Yes, and not to say that she wasn't going out several nights a week and having drinks with people, but when she was supposed to be there with her kids, she was there with her kids. So this was strange. So, of course, Barbara is canceling her plans for the day so that she could help out. She lived only 6 minutes away. She quickly got dressed. She canceled her plans. She left her house 8 minutes later. As she arrived at the Harris home, she noticed Michelle's gold Ford Windstar minivan parked on the side, like kind of still on the street. Now, you have to imagine they do own a large bit of property. It's not like the driveway you might look out your front door and see, where you are literally looking at the street like we do in our house. You can't see the street from the house. It's far. So she obviously found this strange because she's getting the phone call from Cal saying that Michelle didn't come home, but then her minivan's at the end of the drive, like in the street. It didn't make sense.
It's here. She's here somewhere.
Yes. So Barbara got out of her car to investigate, and she saw that Michelle's car was on the road. The doors were unlocked and the keys were in the ignition. From there, she got back into her car. She drove up the driveway, which curved through a quarter mile of woods and fields to the house. Once inside the house, Barbara called out to Michelle, hoping that she would be there. And then maybe for whatever reason, maybe the car stalled, who knows, that she had just walked up to the house. That wasn't the case. Instead of Michelle being there, she saw Cal. He was dressed and ready to go to work, which he did. He left. Or before he left, though, she did. She talked to Cal and she was like, Michelle's car is sitting on the street at the end of the drive. And he said, you know, let's go get it. So the two drove down to inspect the car, and Barbara wondered if maybe Michelle was still in the vicinity. Maybe she was injured or disoriented. Who knows what happened?
Yeah.
So Cal explained that Michelle had gone to New York City, and Barbara said she didn't understand how or why, because her car is sitting here in the road. And Cal voiced that maybe she had hitchhiked. Okay.
Okay.
So as they stood by the car, Cal noted the items inside, which included clothing, mail, magazines, toys, and food wrappers. He mentioned to Barbara that, oh, this car needs to be cleaned. And Barbara found it extremely odd that despite the fact that Michelle was missing, hadn't shown up to be with her kids that day, despite the fact she never would do that, he's focusing on the car needing to be cleaned, to the fact that he instructed Barbara to drop it off at the dealership so he could clean it from top to bottom.
Yeah, he's probably not usually that nice to Michelle, I would guess.
So what made things more confusing was that after the fact, later that day, investigators came across Michelle's cell phone in the car. It had one missed call. They also found a Rolex box with no watch inside. That was one of the pieces of jewelry she was going to pawn. They also found a black bag that contained jewelry. So if she had gone to New York City, she would have taken that black bag with her.
To pawn.
And she would not have left her cell phone behind.
Yep.
She also wouldn't have left her car in the road. So Barbara drove Michelle's van back down the driveway up to the house and parked it in the garage while Cal then left for work. Barbara called a friend of Michelle's and said, "Do you have any idea where Michelle could be?" Nobody knew where Michelle was. This friend went on to call Michelle's divorce lawyer, whom Michelle was scheduled to meet with later that day, which is another reason why she would not have gone to New York that day. She was set to go to New York, I think, the following day and then the next. So after finding that Michelle had left her shift at Lefty's the night before and was not answering her phone and nowhere to be seen, they were clearly concerned. They are the ones that contacted state police to report her missing, not Cal. Michelle's sister-in-law, Shannon, immediately feared the worst when she got the call. She was at work. As she left work after hearing the news of Michelle's disappearance, she basically grabbed her things, turned to her secretary and said, "I'm pretty sure my brother-in-law killed my sister-in-law."
Wow.
So because of the events of September 11th, many of the troopers, because you have to imagine this is happening in New York, many of the troopers and investigators in Tioga County had traveled to New York City to help with what was going on there. Yeah.
Clean up and just safety and just
everything.
You know, everything.
All hands on deck in New York City and Manhattan. So because of that fact, were way, way more limited resources that day than would have been normal for a missing persons case.
Yeah.
Two investigators that were there went to speak with Cal at the dealership at 9:40 a.m. Cal explained that Michelle never came home after her shift the night before. He accompanied the officers back to his home. He gave them written permission to search the house, and then he went off to work. He told them that if they needed to take the minivan, they could. He would eventually need it back, though, because he needed to change the oil because Michelle just wasn't good about it. Cal denied having anything to do with Michelle's disappearance when he was speaking with the police. He suggested they actually take a closer look at Michelle herself. He suggested to investigators that Michelle may have been using cocaine with people that she met in Waverly at work and that they should pump the shit out of them. I don't know what that means, but that's what he said.
Maybe that's something. People that do a lot of cocaine, if you can help us understand what pump the shit out of them means.
I don't know what that means. So the investigators describe Cal as extremely calm and unemotional. He did not appear that he had anything to hide. He was doing nothing to prevent them from looking around. Again, he gave them full permission to search the house and the cars. And in the same sense, though, he almost came across as too cooperative and seemingly programmed in the things that he was saying. It was their impression that something just seemed to be off or missing in his demeanor. So police went on to search the Harris home and property with the use of helicopters, dogs, divers, and sonar, which was used to search the pond. There were various ponds and waters around their house, as well as the 29 acres of Empire Lake, which bordered the property on the east. The search found nothing unusual. They found absolutely no trace of Michelle. While she remained missing, no activity came from her cell phone, which, of course, we later found out the cell phone wouldn't have because it was found in her car. Her bank accounts, her debit cards, nothing was used. So police also spoke with the employees at Lefty's. This included Michael Casper and his friend Michael Hakes, who were with Michelle the night before. Police became suspicious of Michael Casper when they learned through a background check that he did have a history of cocaine use. He had a conviction of assaulting a former girlfriend as well. The other man was even shadier. This is Michael Hakes. He had served a 10-year prison sentence in Arizona for rape.
Jeez, man, she knows how to pick them.
Shady characters. So as the investigation progressed, Casper, Hakes, as well as 23-year-old Brian Earley, who she was dating, all passed lie detector tests. They were ultimately cleared of involvement. Police searched Brian's apartment. There was nothing of concern found. Police were initially very focused on Brian since he was the last known person to see Michelle alive.
Sure.
He told them that when she left, he walked her out to her van. He leaned through her open window to give her a kiss goodbye. He told her he loved her and he would see her the next day. And when she pulled away, this was the last time that he saw her.
So obviously they focus on Brian and Cal.
Yep. So Brian told investigators that he loved Michelle. He was hoping to marry her as soon as her divorce was final. Barbara knew that this was not what where Michelle was mentally. You know, he was maybe moving a little quicker than her because, you know, she has just been going through a divorce. She was not going to turn around and remarry him. In December of 2001, Brian went on to move back to Philadelphia. He rekindled his relationship with the girlfriend that he left to be with Michelle. They actually ended up getting married and moving to Tioga County in 2002.
Weird.
So investigators quickly turned their focus back to Cal Harris, of course. So they called in a forensic specialist, Steve Anderson, and he was sent to the Harris home to take a closer look. Anderson found tiny specks of blood on the kitchen doorway that previous investigators who had been in the home 2 days earlier had not seen.
Nice.
It was quite obvious to Anderson that this was blood splatter, or spatter, I should say, and they could be potentially dealing with a crime scene here. Police knew that Cal had a strong motive to kill his wife since they were in the midst of a large settlement. They were planning on going to trial the following month. So the findings of blood was used to obtain a search warrant, which found similar stains in the foyer and the kitchen near the garage, and a presumptive test confirmed that the substance was human blood, which was preserved for later DNA testing. There was no way to determine, though, how long had the blood been there. That was impossible. Anderson believed that additional blood had been present but had since been cleaned, and the house was deemed a crime scene. Cal initially said he could not think of any reason that blood would be where they found it, but then he later remembered that his son had cut his finger. He had left a few drops of blood in the garage. Blood experts later determined that the small dots of blood were at an angle that proved that the victim would have been at or below 29 inches at like height at that point.
Wow, that's very detailed.
Yeah. So that same day, Cal met Michelle's family for dinner. Two of her sisters actually confronted him there about the threat that he had made toward Michelle in March about killing her and disposing of her body in a way where she would never be found.
Good for them.
They also referenced something that happened in 1996 when Michelle called from a closet and said that Cal was standing outside the door and he had cocked a shotgun.
Which is why they probably removed all the firearms in the house.
Right, using this specifically. Cal initially denied these threats. He eventually admitted that, yes, I did say them. He was simply only joking.
Funny.
That's where I'm like, jokes are supposed to be funny.
Yeah.
So police searched Michelle's van as well as Cal's truck and ATV. Fingerprints belonging to Cal and Brian were found in the car as well as a third person, but no blood was found in any of those vehicles. So police also monitored Cal's home. They utilized night vision goggles and camouflage. They also attached a GPS tracking unit to his truck for 6 months in hopes that he would lead them to her body.
Yeah, go check on it or something.
Neither of these things provided any useful information. As the initial investigation was complete, the case started to grow cold over the next few years. It was absolutely the police belief that Cal was the killer and then he somehow disposed of Michelle's body, but they truly just lacked sufficient evidence to solidify a conviction. There was no body, there was no murder weapon. Beyond the specks of blood, there wasn't even proof that Michelle was dead. You know, it could have been a Gone Girl type of situation.
Yeah.
But, you know, obviously people that knew Michelle were like, absolutely not.
No, she's dead somewhere. It's a matter of finding her.
Mm-hmm. So as the years ticked by, Cal quickly began a relationship with an old girlfriend only 3 weeks after Michelle disappeared. Barbara continued to watch the kids for the next year. She noticed that Cal never once asked if she had heard from Michelle or even mentioned her name. Barbara described Cal as an explosive person who had a temper, yet throughout this time that Michelle was missing, he was uncharacteristically calm, cool, and collected. Gary Taylor, who is Michelle's dad, felt that Cal showed an apparent lack of concern. He never called Gary, never touched base on anything. Not only that, but he never, ever tried to call Michelle when she wasn't home the morning of September 12th, when she, you know, had disappeared. And he never tried to track her down, not one time. And police found it extremely strange that the mother of his children, who was there every single morning to take care of them, wasn't there, and he never once tried to call her. Did he not try to call her because he knew exactly where she was and she wouldn't be answering that phone? I mean, that's what it would tell me.
Yeah, suspicious, but not illegal.
Right. So when Cal did attend family events with the children, he avoided all eye contact with, which made the family, you know, very suspicious of them. It was fully their belief that he was 100% the murderer. So only days after Michelle disappeared, Cal also began packing up all of Michelle's belongings and instructed Barbara to sell them in a garage sale. This was very alarming to Barbara. She could not understand why he assumed she would not be coming back. It had only been a week that she was missing at that point. After 4 years, there was still no sign of Michelle, and on September 30th, 2005, Cal was arrested and charged with Michelle's murder.
Boom.
We have no idea like what finally pushed them to do it on this day.
Okay.
He was not only arrested in front of his employees, but his hands were placed in handcuffs while his legs were placed in irons or leg cuffs.
Oh, that's awesome. At the dealership?
Yep.
Oh, that's the best. Yep. I'm sure they were like, let's get him at his home. They're like, actually, let's wait like an hour and a half and we're going to do it at the dealership.
Yeah, right in front of everybody.
People there trying to buy a Ford truck or something like, well, I don't know if I'm going to buy from this place. What'd that guy do to the last guy?
So defense attorney Joe Cawley was fully confident that because of the lack of physical evidence or a body, Cal would never be convicted, as the lack of evidence was a reasonable doubt in itself.
Yeah.
So after nearly 6 years of Michelle being gone, the trial began on May 21st, 2007. Cal had been out on a $500,000 bail. He arrived at the courthouse from the home where authorities were convinced that Michelle had been murdered. District Attorney Jerry Keene was aware that there was no body, no witness, no murder weapon. He had never been part of a case like this that had actually led to a conviction.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's one of those things. Everybody knows he probably did it, but you can't convict. It's like innocent until proven guilty, mm-hmm. So prove it. And they have nothing to prove it with. So I don't even know how this is allowed to be a case.
So the prosecution painted a picture of what they believe happened to Michelle after she left Brian's home at about 11:15 p.m. on September 11th, 2001. They said that she went directly home. She parked her minivan in the garage. As soon as she entered the kitchen through the garage, this is when Cal struck and murdered her. He had the rest of the night to dispose of Michelle's body in a way that would never be found. He attempted to clean the kitchen, and then he moved Michelle's van to the bottom of the driveway so it appeared that she had never come up to the house at all that night. He then cleaned himself up. He called Barbara at 7 a.m. to watch the kids so that she would be the one to just stumble upon the car at the road. The theory is built simply on premise. There's no proof that Michelle actually came into the home at approximately 11:30 p.m. on the night of September 11th.
Yeah, this might as well be any other story that anybody else is saying. Mm-hmm. Like, there's okay, yeah, this is your theory. Next.
So the blood found in the home was truly the main focus at the trial. This included 6 drops of Michelle's blood on the doorway between the kitchen and the garage, more drops on the kitchen throw rug, as well as the garage floor. The spots were extremely small. They were not indicative of criminal conduct, according to the defense. It wasn't a huge amount of blood. It was actually a very small amount of blood.
Yeah, maybe she stubbed her toe or something, you know?
So Lee felt, based on the pattern of blood... Oh, I'm sorry. I skipped ahead. Because of the blood evidence was the main piece of the case, the prosecution utilized renowned criminologist Henry Lee, who testified on videotape. Lee was best known for his work during the O.J. Simpson trial, and he indicated that in this case, the blood told the story of what happened to Michelle. Lee felt that based on the pattern of the blood in the doorway, Michelle was hit twice. The first punch would have knocked her down. The second caused her blood to fly. Red dye was used to demonstrate the spatter, similar to what was found in the Harris home. Based on how the blood source was broken into smaller droplets that propelled horizontally through the air, it told investigators that some force had been used. When asked if it was enough to tell Lee if it was a crime scene, he felt yes, the very potential of a crime scene was there. Defense attorneys maintain that because it was such a small amount of blood, there was no way to indicate that this was a crime scene.
Yeah, like he's just saying potential.
Mm-hmm. So investigator Anderson felt that some kind of blunt instrument, such as a hammer or even a fist, had been used. So who knows? I mean, maybe at that point in time, there was no murder weapon to dispose of. If he had literally just punched her and then choked her, his murder weapons would be on his hands.
Yeah. And Cal seems like he's going to get off with this as long as he stays quiet.
Right. And, you know, the fact that the blood spatter was in a pattern that isn't something you typically find in the house, because obviously people are like, well, you know, the house has two adults and four children living in it. People cut themselves, people bleed. But because if it was something typical, like you cut yourself or you get a nosebleed, it would present in a dripped blood rather than a spatter, because spatter is like moving, you know, like even if it was blood, say you cut your finger and you swung your finger, it would be much fatter pieces of blood. Yeah, rather than
the velocity of the blood. There's some velocity behind it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's why they said it wasn't typical of a cut you would get in the house.
Right. But is it possible? Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. So in total, there were more than 40 tiny drops of blood in the kitchen and a square stain of blood on the rug that could have been from the murder weapon. Because of the fact that blood found was red in appearance, it indicated that the blood was fresh. However, we do know that they said there was truly no way of saying this is fresh blood versus old blood. Dr. Henry Lee had never been at the crime scene itself. His opinion was based solely on his view of the pictures that were taken at the crime scene. So blood was never found in any of the cars or in the sink traps of the house, which led to the defense to question, if Cal had murdered Michelle, how did he move her body? How did he clean the crime scene? And, you know, you could think that maybe he incapacitated her by striking her, which caused that splatter or spatter. I always want to say splatter. But then maybe he choked her to death. So there wouldn't be any blood found in any of the sink traps. They also argued that, you know, the cars, there was no blood found in the cars. The defense also argued that the police had not sufficiently focused on Brian Earley, as his apartment and car had never been searched for the presence of blood. Michael Casper and Michael Hake's apartments had also never been searched. Hake's body had never been examined to look to see if he had signs of like defensive wounds on him.
Well, that's because they couldn't get a search warrant, because it's just like kind of hearsay. Mm-hmm. Like Earley, they're like, oh, well, he has a pass, but that doesn't mean he was directly connected. Like there was nothing that showed.
Right.
Like if he had, you know, something else, some other kind of evidence, they could have got it. But they, you know, the thing with Cal is Cal allowed them to search in the house, I think it sounds like.
Yeah,
and then
he
they found that blood. So that's why they had the search. Yeah, I guess maybe they never asked the other guys. But
well, the point is with Michael Casper and Michael Hakes, we know that Michelle left them because she did go to Brian's apartment. So Brian is the last known person to see her.
Yeah, it would make sense to at least ask him.
But, you know, the police did say that the men were fully cooperative during the investigation and they had no motive for murder. There was no reason for them to kill Michelle, whereas obviously Cal had a big motive.
Yeah.
They all passed polygraph tests, which is something that Cal refused to do. Mm. Cal chose not to testify during his trial. And on June 6, 2007, after 2 weeks of testimony, the case went to jury. After less than 4 hours of deliberation over the course of 2 days, the jury returned with a verdict. As the verdict was read, the Harris family, who sat to the left side of the room, held their breath as Cal cried. What do you think was their verdict?
Well, if he cried, I'm going to say...
Well, this is before they read it. He didn't know.
Oh, he was crying.
He was crying as they were preparing to read it.
I like that you did this. This is a good idea. No freaking way can you say that he's guilty. You can't. If you're like actually following the letter of the law, he's not guilty because there's no evidence pointing to it. There's nothing. There's literally nothing. This like basically one dude saying, yeah, it looks like it could be a crime scene. That's really all you have.
There was definitely blood spatter in the house.
Yeah, I still
in like, several locations.
Yeah, is that beyond a shadow of a doubt? No.
It's
in my like, so I'm very analytical. I follow the word of like how things are supposed to work. And believe me, I feel that it was definitely 90% chance that Cal did this. Mm-hmm. But like by how we're set up in this country, that is not guilty.
So Calvin Harris was convicted of second degree murder of his wife Michelle Harris.
That's really dangerous too, because that's setting a precedent. A little bit. I don't know, you know, lawyers chime in here, but you know, a lot of people are going to be pointing to this when there's not a lot of evidence to be had. That's what's also worrisome as a judge. You're like, this is going to set a precedent and other people might go to jail that maybe aren't guilty.
Well, it's the jurors that, you know, made this decision.
Yeah.
So Cal's attorneys were shocked, having been fully confident that due to the lack of evidence, he would be found not guilty.
I mean, I'm shaking my head, but at the same time, he killed her. So.
Right. A male juror indicated that he felt that the evidence was overwhelming and all the little pieces came together as a whole puzzle. Jurors also felt that Cal's own actions were very telling. The fact that he never once joined the search for his wife, he didn't stay home from work that day, he never tried to call her, it was all very telling.
And the prosecution definitely sounds like they put together a fantastic story. Like they must have hired some people, like storytellers or something. Like that was, sounds like that's what got him.
And they said that the blood evidence played a large role. It told the story of Michelle being murdered in her home, which would have eliminated other possible subjects because it would have happened at home where Cal was. So 2 months later and days before Cal's sentencing, a new witness came forward. This is 23-year-old Kevin Tubbs. He's a local farmer that said that on the morning that Michelle disappeared, he drove past the Harris driveway slowly at about 5:30 a.m. He was driving especially slow because he had poor brakes on his truck and he was towing something. He's a farmer and it's dark-ish. The sun was like barely rising. He said that there was a man in his mid-20s at the back of a pickup truck and a woman on the side that had blonde hair. She appeared to be crying. The man also appeared a little upset. The woman was believed to be Michelle. She fit the description of Michelle. The man at the back of the pickup truck was described as young with dark hair and a dark complexion. He wore a white t-shirt. If Tubbs truly saw who he believed was Michelle when he did, Cal would not have had time to kill Michelle because at 7 a.m. he called Barbara and said, "Hey, she's not here. Can you come up to the house?" However, investigators believe that Tubbs was mistaken, and at the time that he drove by, the lighting would have been too dark. He agreed that it was dark, he said, but the way that the road turned, my headlights were directly on them. He also did admit that he didn't get an extremely close look. He couldn't say that he was 100% certain. He only said what he saw.
Why did this dumb asshole wait so long to come forward?
And Tubbs had waited 6 years.
What the frick is wrong with people? Like, this is something in your own town. You saw something and you remember this. Oh yeah, but you know, I'm pretty sure I remember this. I can't wait to hear that he like worked for Cal at some point.
Well, that's what I'd say. Like, did they check his financials? Did he get a nice hefty check from Dwight Harris,
right?
Perhaps.
Right.
There was no evidence of that. Nothing mentioned about that. And to back that, another nearby resident, John Steele, also claimed to be driving through the area at 6 a.m. Of course, Tubbs would have been about a half hour earlier. That same morning when he also saw a truck at the end of the Harris driveway.
And that dumb asshole also waited six years?
He didn't come forward.
You're both useless human beings, but go ahead.
He thought that he overheard the man by the truck telling the woman, "Get in the car, just get in the damn car." Steele had given a written account of what he had seen. He shortly died thereafter. So his statement was never offered as part of the evidence towards the trial. They took what Tubbs said into consideration. And the judge believed that what Tubbs saw, and he threw out Cal's conviction. So Cal was found guilty, thrown out. He was allowed to go home on bail for the next 2 years.
Thrown out being no conviction, everything. This is enough evidence to say it might not have been him.
Yes. So the defense maintained that Michelle never entered her home that night. They believe that after she left Brian's house, she met up with two men. These are two totally different names that are coming up. This is Stacy Stewart and Christopher Thomason. They are from Texas, and they came to the Tioga area in 2001 for steel work with a local manufacturer. They were staying at a hotel only a half mile from Lefty's, where Michelle worked. They met her because she waited tables. She waited on them several times, and they eventually started hanging out outside of work. So in August of 2001, Stewart purchased a home about 7 miles from the Harris home. And within a few months of her disappearance, both Stewart and Thomason abruptly left the area. They relocated back to Texas without as much as notifying their work. Stewart had bought that house. He abandoned it. He didn't even bother to list it for sale. He stopped paying the mortgage on it.
Oh, weird.
Very quick. Very shady. Oh my God. So according to Thomason, on the night that Michelle was last seen, she was at the bar with them. And when he left, at the time he departed, she was alive and well. She was hanging out with Stewart. He said that Stewart was interested in Michelle. And when he left, they were sitting together at the bar. It was Thomason's opinion that Michelle had been murdered and Stacy Stewart was responsible. He said that he would have likely buried her in concrete. Stewart maintains that he was actually home alone. However, he had no alibi because he was home alone.
Sure.
He said that he had no interest in her, and it was Thomason, actually, that had the sexual relationship with Michelle. He even made a point of saying, like, I know so little of her, I wasn't even sure of what her name was. But other people are like, no, he knew her more than that.
Yeah.
So the man that Tubbs identified seeing near the pickup truck at 5:30 in the morning on the morning of September 12th fit the description of Stacy Stewart.
Weird.
He described the man as white, 5'8" to 5'10", early to mid-20s in age, tan skin, brown hair, wearing blue jeans and a white t-shirt with a muscular build. And this fit exactly the description of Stacy Stewart.
Wow.
So the truck was described as dark blue. He specifically said it looked like a Chevy truck, and it was confirmed that Stewart owned and was driving a black Chevy pickup truck at the time. So the property that Stewart owned, by this time that they're like looking into this, because we know that Tubbs didn't come back to tell anybody anything for 6 years. We know that Stewart just literally up and left his new property without paying any bills, just left. So by the time the police are looping back around, somebody else owns the property and they're giving consent to look and you can come and see. So the property that he did own at the time, it was large and it was an underdeveloped area with woods and ponds nearby. Plenty of spaces to discard of a body. A number of witnesses indicate overhearing Stewart and Thomason talking about burning evidence, specifically mentioning bloody clothing. Mm. The burn pit on the property that Stewart owned was searched on January 8th, 2016, which found various items, including the partial strap of a woman's bra, a woman's bathing suit or halter top, two pieces of fabric that had been charred, and the clasp and latch of what was soon identified as a woman's handbag. Those are odd things to find in a burn pit.
No kidding.
We have a fire pit in our backyard. I've never thrown my bra in there. I've never thrown a handbag in there.
You don't wear bras in public or anywhere. You just let them hang.
I let these bean bags just hang free. So the charred fabric matched that of what would have been Michelle's uniform at Lefty's.
Wow.
It was the khaki shorts and a navy shirt.
How freaking bizarre. What a turn.
So again, though, because so much time had gone by, there was no identifiable DNA profiles to prove that these were Michelle's clothing items. When Stacy's truck was able to be located, it had already been auctioned off and sold. They found it. They tracked it down. It was in Texas. The new owner allowed the search, and bloodstains were found on the back seats and the door panels, as well as a diamond earring found behind the passenger side seat belt retractor that Cal said he had bought his wife,
Michelle,
similar pair.
Oh my God.
And that's, I'm sorry, I have owned so many cars. I've never bled in my car. Have you? Have you ever been bleeding in your car?
Honestly, there's a good chance I cut myself.
Well,
all
you
the time.
Do. Because if you get mad at something, like if say you're trying to get the ice maker out and it's jammed, you just start like beating it.
I have a scar right here because last week I did that.
I'm like, why are you doing that? You know this is going to result in you bleeding.
This sounds really bad. I would never do anything to a human being, but like machines that are supposed to work, I punch them sometimes.
Yeah, and he does, and he gets crazy.
You
like,
should see our
toaster oven. Yeah, we have like a oven. It's kind of like a multi-cooker thing.
Yeah.
And you beat the shit out of it. It has a dent in the side.
It's an air fryer, a Cuisinart air fryer. Everybody probably has one. And yeah, the toast function doesn't work. The damn thing, we paid $150. It's like, and I got it replaced because the toast function doesn't work. So we have a perfectly good new one in the other room, but I want this. I'm so cheap that I want this one to last as long as we can. So if anything happens to it, I start punching it in the side and slamming it.
So it's dented. It's literally dented because of my wild animal of a husband beats it. And let me tell you, just a quick funny side note, Cuisinart wanted him to cut the cord before sending the new replacement
so that somebody can't pick it out of the trash and then try to use it and then it's like, oh, Cuisinart sucks,
or we lie and say it doesn't work. So Mike sent me a picture of what he sent to the company, and it was just like a picture of a cord that hadn't been cut.
I turned the cord around and so just like held it underneath, and then it looked like it was kind of the end of the cord, not really cut, and then they were like, yeah, sounds good.
Oh my God, I was laughing my ass off when that happened. Okay, but I digress. So again, a lot of time had passed at this point. So even the blood that they found in the truck that had belonged to Stacy, it couldn't necessarily be linked to Michelle. but very suspicious. We're finding pieces of clothing in a burn pit that potentially matches what Michelle wore to Lefty's that night. There's blood in the truck, and there's an earring in a spot that the new owner would have never found. Because that's another thing. I was like, how did the new owner not find the earring? It was like behind a seatbelt retractor.
Couldn't they get some DNA from the earring?
No, because so much time had passed. Uh-huh. Because of the age of the evidence, full DNA sequence was not able to connect these pieces with Michelle.
That sucks.
So in July of 2009, Cal once again went to trial for the murder of his wife. This time he took the stand. He denied having anything to do with Michelle's disappearance. What he said varied from what other witnesses say happened, though. Barbara Thayer told the jury that she had called Michelle's phone from the Harris home on the morning that Michelle disappeared, whereas Cal is testifying, no, I made that call. Barbara maintained, this is absolutely not true. I made that call. And why would Barbara lie about that?
It's also memory fades after 6 years. So
you know, if you called someone.
I'm not to defend this guy. Please don't get mad at me, but my memory is kind of shaky. True. So, I mean, I could see myself getting that. I'm like, I swear I called him. But if you say you did, then I guess that's okay.
Okay. And you guys, I have to tell you something funny about Mike. He does not necessarily like true crime, and he erases his memory of these cases. It could be Tuesday. Now, mind you, our cases come out on Sunday, and I'll be like, hey, remember blah, blah, blah. And he's like, no. I'm like, literally like 2 days ago when we did this. Remember that?
And then you give a few more details. I'm like, nope.
And I'm like, this is weird.
I really, really don't like it. And I love, you know, delivering the stories, and I like to be able to
remember
people. Yeah. To watch out for things and things. But he's just like, I compartmentalize it and then I flush it down the toilet.
So in this case, I could see you being like, I truly don't remember, and maintaining that.
Yeah.
But then again, it also meant they mentioned the whole idea that really within a week of Michelle going missing, that's when Cal was trying to get rid of her belongings, asking Barbara to sell them in a garage sale. He's saying, that was never my idea. That was Barbara's idea. And Barbara's like, nope, that is absolutely untrue. Cal is simply a liar, and he's also a good one.
Wow.
After a nearly 3 week trial and 10 hours of jury deliberation on the second trial, a decision was made. What do you think that decision is, Michael?
Not guilty. 100% not guilty.
Cal was found guilty.
Whoa! Again. Those sons of bitches.
Two times in a row.
Good job.
Prosecutor Jerry Keene was exceptionally thankful. He felt that this was the hardest case he had ever prosecuted. The decision was bittersweet for Michelle's family. They knew that the four children are going to be the ones to suffer because now they don't have their mother. They also don't have their father. But they realized that Cal was responsible for what had happened, whatever happened to Michelle, and that he had to pay for what he had done. The family continued to hold out hope that one day Michelle's body would be found and she could be laid to rest. Cal was sentenced to 25 years to life in prison, and the four Harris children were sent to live with Cal's aunt. Cal appealed to the Court of Appeals, and a third trial was ordered.
Okay.
Because two procedural errors happened. So in the meantime, Cal was released on yet again another $500,000 bail after he had spent 38 months in prison. The case went to jury in May of 2015. It was resulted in a mistrial. So there was 11 days of deliberations. They could not come to a decision. Now we're moving on to a fourth trial in the following year. And during this trial, a witness who was convicted of murder came forward after being incarcerated with Cal. He claimed that he overheard Cal threaten to another inmate saying, I will make you disappear just like I made my wife disappear.
Yeah, right.
However, in the midst of his testimony, the witness suddenly pleaded the fifth and refused to speak further. So his testimony was removed from the record. On May 24th, 2016, they came back with another verdict. Mike.
Guilty.
Not guilty.
I got them all wrong. Oh my God.
And this is something he had maintained for 15 years by this point.
Sheesh.
His four children, who by this time were estranged from Michelle's family, stood by their father's side throughout this whole ordeal.
Wow.
His 20-year-old daughter, Kayla, said that her father had been gone for 4 years at one point, which was very difficult on her and her siblings. The long legal battle, has financially drained a large portion of Cal's fortune. I mean, he got himself out on bail on two separate times with $500,000. I can't imagine the lawyer's fees and all of that.
You only have to post a portion of that.
And I do know that.
They give it back to you once you show
oh,
up.
Oh, really?
It's okay. Like it's making sure that you show up for court.
Okay.
Shows how correct much me I if know. I'm wrong. That's what my assumption is.
Okay.
So I don't think you actually give it to the state.
Mm. So, you know, at this point, he doesn't have quite the financial situation he had before. He moved to sell his 250-acre estate. And, you know, that he and his wife had owned. And his children now look for ways to move forward together. As the fourth trial ended, Cal's children range between the ages of 17 and 21 years old. They had mostly grown up without their mother. I mean, the youngest, he certainly won't remember his mother. He was just a baby.
Yeah.
It's very sad. So Cal's children really just want to honor their mother's memory. They wanted her memory to not be forgotten. They recall their mom as someone with a smile that would just light up a room. They are trying to be the people that she would want them to be. Michelle Harris's body nor the murder weapon has ever been found.
Crazy.
And it has been coming up on, 23 years this year that she's disappeared. And we have no idea who did this to her and what happened to her.
What do you think? You did all the research. And obviously, keep in mind, you've probably read a lot of very slanted takes on things, you know, especially on blogs and stuff.
Right.
But honestly, like any kind of information, like there's always some slant on something. Mm-hmm. So what do you feel?
I mean, obviously, for the get-go, I was 100% sold on the fact that Cal did this.
Yeah. Why would those like other guys kill her? Did they have
who knows? They could have made a pass on her in the bar and she said no.
Right.
You know, but they didn't say much about their backgrounds. There was very little about them as people per se.
Weird that they moved away right away.
They immediately moved away, left their jobs without word,
and then
left their house without word.
Could Cal have like planned that whole thing, you know, invited them, be like, all right, you got to get like close with her at the bar, and then I want you to take care of her.
No evidence of that.
Right. Yeah.
What do you think?
I mean, okay, everybody points to like how he didn't try looking for her, but he kind of hated her at that point, right?
But still, it's the mother of your children, and she didn't show up. Like, at the very least, I'd call and be like, where the F are you?
Right, like mad.
Like, hello, you're not here, and Barbara's off today, and you've left me hanging with the kids, and I got to go to work.
True.
I would 100% give you a rage call if you and I were getting a divorce, you were supposed to be there, and you didn't show up.
Yeah, I could see that. That's a great
so
point.
So I find it very freaking strange. He never placed one call because when there was her cell phone found, it had one missed call. It was not Cal. Hmm. I find that very strange. And if he had killed her and disposed of her body, he would not have called her. Well, I mean, he should have called her to make it look like he was at least trying to look for her.
Yeah.
But he didn't. I find that telling. And the fact that he was giving her clothes away after a week.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, a lot of things point to him being guilty of this. I mean, that's, yeah.
Yeah. So you think still Cal,
yeah, for sure. Yeah. Especially how many times he threatened her and stuff. It's just like he seems like a violent individual.
What about the clothing and the burn pit and, you know, the blood in Stuart's car?
It's totally weird. That's
and
why
the earring.
That's why I'm not like 100%. It's just kind of odd. But
and two separate people saying they saw that dark pickup truck at 5:30 and at 6 a.m. and
that's weird that they didn't step up until like right before.
I find
that
weird.
Like Cal, that just reeks of allegedly like some kind of a payment, you know? I'm not saying this happened, but like
we're just speculating.
And it's not like Cal was like a billionaire. Like he had $5 million, which is a really good amount of money, but it's that's worth.
So we
that's
don't know much. What Dwight Harris was worth, his
oh,
dad.
Oh, true.
What you know, he could have been sitting on a fortune.
Yeah, that's true. And he can make things happen.
You can make things happen. You don't want to tarnish the name.
Well, right. Especially with a dealership. That's your name.
Yeah.
It's like Harris Ford or whatever. You
right.
know? So, yeah, it's probably worth it. You know, like an investment portion of it.
It's just sad to me that we'll never know what happened to Michelle, and she'll probably never ever be found. She'll never be laid to rest because there was a lot of property on both spots that they looked at, both Stewart's area as well as the Harris home. There is a lot of property, a lot of places that a body can be concealed, and odds are Michelle will never be laid to rest and her family will never have that closure.
Yeah.
Even though I know they know she's not with us any longer, it's tough.
Yeah,
I feel
kids,
for them terribly.
You know,
I feel for the kids.
They don't know for sure.
It's hard.
Yeah. I'm sure one of them at some point will be like, man, maybe dad did do it. Who knows? Well, thank you so much for telling her story. It's important to remember these poor people that, you know, had their lives taken from them. And, you know, yeah, just watch out for people like that. It's tough. So thank you all for listening. We really appreciate it. Like we said, if you enjoy what we do and want to support this Mom and Pop podcast, then come on over to Patreon or Apple subscriptions and get yourself access to 40 plus episodes. But in the meantime, I want to say welcome to our latest Crime and Coffee Couple Club members, Stacy, Katie, Janet, Crystal, Moogly, and Susie. Oh, Moogly is, it's a... She has like a gaming channel, actually.
Oh, cool.
So, okay, cool. Well, welcome. Thank you all so much.
Yeah, thank you guys so much.
All right.
And we appreciate each and every one of you for being here, listening, supporting us. And we'll be back again, actually, this coming Wednesday with a bonus episode and then next week with a regular one. And until next time, bye!